fifth case today, Maimonis against Urbanski and the Elmer School District. Mr. Spiegel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew Spiegel. I'm representing Catherine Maimonis on this appeal. And we go from stealing horses in Indiana.
No, just stealing saddles.
Just stealing saddles to whether or not...
Stealing the whole horse would almost certainly be a capital offense in Indiana, or at least Texas.
Well, but the question that you have to ask in this case is, are we going to condone guilt by association, and do students still have a Fourth Amendment right to their personal property even when they're in school? What happened in this case takes us back to December 8, 2003. On that day, which I think we can take judicial note, the court can take judicial notice, was a Monday. Catherine drove her sister, Rachel, and a friend of Rachel's to school.
Okay. Here, the arrested individuals were smoking a one-hitter in the back seat, but the three marijuana cigarette butts are in the front seat ashtray. Miss Maimonis' sister told the police she didn't know where those butts were found. Given that those butts appear unrelated to the smoking incident, and that Miss Maimonis had exited that front seat not long before the search and driven the car containing three people to school that morning, isn't it reasonable, wasn't it reasonable to suspect that she was involved with at least one of those three marijuana butts?
No. And the reason for that is clear from the record. If you look at the police report that is in the appendix, it clearly states that while she was perhaps unaware of where the three marijuana cigarette butts were found, she Rachel, admitted that they were hers. And the test in the Seventh Circuit for searching...
And the police are, as a matter of law, required to believe felons? That is, people people who are confessing to a crime and then say, and I'm trying to exculpate somebody else, the police are required to believe that?
No. But Mr. Urbanski...
Mr. Good thing, too, because you'd have to have a pretty gullible police force who believed all of these things.
And I agree with Your Honor, but Mr. Urbanski was required to observe conduct on the part of Catherine Maimonis that gave him reasonable grounds to ask for the search of her purse. What did she do?
Why do you need reasonable grounds to ask for anything? The Supreme Court has said over and over and over that you need no grounds whatsoever to ask for consent to search. The question in this case was not whether the police or the principal or the dean, apparently, needed grounds to ask for consent, nor was there any actual search. The question is whether it is legally permissible to draw an adverse inference from failure to consent under these circumstances. Now, your brief never addresses that question. Your brief treats this as if either there was a search, which there wasn't, or as if you needed probable cause to ask for consent, which you don't.
But okay.
This is your opportunity to address the adverse inference question, which is the only thing that matters.
Well, and if you look at the Supreme Court cases on this issue, which is New Jersey versus TLO.
No, New Jersey against TLO was a search case. I want you to address the question whether one can draw an adverse inference if consent is refused, or the circumstances under which one can draw such an adverse inference in a civil proceeding.
Well, are you asking?
Not a criminal process.
Are you asking that in a vacuum? I mean,
given the
fact that
this in a courtroom.
No, but, I mean, in the context of this case or in general?
In the context of a courtroom where I presume that you would then have access to sources in law for dealing with adverse inferences. Now, the leading Supreme Court case on this question is Baxter against Palmigiano, which neither side discusses. Perhaps if you know that case, you could discuss it now, or you might want to discuss some other case on the drawing of adverse inferences.
Well, we didn't discuss cases on the drawing of adverse inferences, because if you look at the cases on what is required for a school official to search the private person of a student.
There was no search.
I know, but he attempted to search. This is what
there was a request for consent, which requires no cause whatever. Now, I'm giving you the opportunity to address the only thing that matters. I can't force you to do it.
Okay, there's no adverse inference that is properly drawn from her refusing to consent because she had a Fourth Amendment right not to consent to that search.
That argument was rejected in Baxter against Palmigiano. The Supreme Court distinguished inferences that may be drawn in criminal prosecutions, where the inference indeed may not be drawn, from what may be done in non-criminal, that is, civil matters, where the court held that an inference may be drawn. Now, I wonder why this case would be treated any differently.
Well, because what inference could he draw in the circumstances of this case? She parked her car, went to first period class, and was engaged in no disruptive conduct.
But she'd been in the car shortly before the incident, in the front seat where the butts were found. The arrested individuals had been smoking in the back seat, and the pen shaft, one hit her, was found there. So there is reason to believe that the butts in the front seat were related to a different incident. There are three butts found, which correspond to the number of the persons in the car driven by Melmanis, and the butts were found within a short period of the time after she had been in the vehicle, because, you know, she's removed from her first period class. So why isn't that enough to justify the inquiry in the case?
Because there's no fact established in the record how long those butts were in the ashtray, if they were in there a week, if they had just been smoked, who smoked them, whether there was, you know, there's just no evidence from which to determine who smoked those butts, when they smoked those butts, or how long they'd been in the ashtray. Instead, you have a student who is attending first period class, minding her own business, and then the dean comes up to her and requests that she consent to a search of her purse. And she refused to consent. Now, it should be pointed out that she was not the only driver of that car. She did not own the car. And the defendants, in their statement of facts, claim that she is the regular owner or regular driver of the vehicle, but their statement of facts does not have any citation to the record of where that fact comes from, and that fact is not in the record. We don't know. We do know that this is a Wisconsin registered car. We know that she is not the owner of the vehicle. All we know is that she drove it that day, she went to first period class, was engaged in that class, and then the dean came up to her and wanted to search her bag, her purse. This, he had witnessed no conduct on her part that would have given him grounds to search the bag. And if we can contrast that with a criminal case that just came out of the 7th District, or the 3rd District, excuse me, that's the Klein case. And the Klein case that I cited pursuant to 28J happened just a few months before in the Nutria High School, and that was September 2003. In that case, they got a confidential tip that this particular student, Brandon Klein, had a quantity of marijuana on him. They, on that basis, undertook the search, and in the criminal context, they found even that was not probable cause for a search. So here, there was no grounds for Dean Urbanski to conduct the search, and I don't think that he could properly draw any adverse inferences from her refusal, because there's no fact in the record that shows that she knew anything about her sister or the sister's friend going back to smoke the one-hitter or whatever else was going on in the car.
When you say going back, is there evidence that the two in the back seat had left the car?
I believe that the evidence was that they three of them left the car. Catherine went back to class. Then, unbeknownst to Catherine, the other two returned to the vehicle. Because if we have a chance to amend the complaint, we would allege that, in fact, Catherine believed that the vehicle was locked and that nobody could get in the car. And I had wanted to reserve some time for rebuttal, but perhaps the court will give me one more minute after.
Thank you, Mr. Spiegel.
Thank you.
Ms. Bohm.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Christy Bowman for defendants. To address a few issues that were just raised regarding the Klein case, first, it's important to note, and I was provided with this very recently, the confidential tip that was made through the hotline has a very different sort of reliability than the actual discovery of illegal drugs in a car in the parking lot, that car having been driven to school approximately an hour earlier. Additionally, in the Klein case, there was much more extensive police involvement than there was in these in the facts presented or alleged in this case. Additionally, with regard to the comment that Catherine Mimonis was not the only driver of the car, did not own the car, certainly we did not address this extensively. However, I would be curious how many high school students actually own the car and are entitled on the car that they're driving. Now, regarding the adverse inference, I'm generally familiar with the Baxter case, which certainly gives the school districts more leeway in this situation, given that we are talking about a civil context. And one case that I will provide in a 28J supplemental actually applies that logic in a school district setting, and that is the Bills case. It's a Northern District case, 967 F sub 1063. And there, in that situation, a student was presented with essentially information that the student had an opportunity. Well, it was probative information. It was probative evidence against the student. The student, in fact, declined to make any sort of comment, and in that situation, the court held it was appropriate for the school officials to make an adverse inference based on the fact that the student had been presented with this evidence and declined to comment.
Ms. Bowman, Ms. Mimonis contends that she was initially suspended for gross disobedience and misconduct in refusing to allow the search of her purse, but that later she received notice that she was actually suspended for possession of the controlled substance that was found in the car that she drove. Was she provided with the informal hearing that Goss requires for the allegation of possession, or was that hearing limited to the earlier charge of gross disobedience and misconduct?
She most certainly was provided with the hearing that Goss v. Lopez requires. Now, Goss sent for a suspension of 10 days or less, Goss requires first notice of the claims and some kind of notice and some kind of hearing is the actual language from Goss v. Lopez. Now here, when we look back at the complaint that was filed and the proposed amended complaints, we see that right from the beginning, when Ms. Mimonis was pulled out of class, she was aware that, in fact, she was under suspicion for having illegal drugs in her car. And her conversations with the dean related to the illegal drugs in her car and the dean's request to search her purse related to that.
So is your answer to my question that she and or her father or she or her father had an opportunity to respond to that charge as Goss requires?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Okay, the charge that she possessed.
The charge that she possessed marijuana. Again, given that there was marijuana in the car that she drove to school that day just in the parking lot. We contend, in fact, there were two hearings, it appears, from the facts that she's presented. The first hearing when she initially had the informal discussion with Dean Urbanski, an informal discussion and a student's opportunity to tell her side of the story is sufficient procedural due process under Goss. That was the first hearing. The second hearing, a short while later, a matter of minutes later, actually, was involving Ms. Mimonis, her father, and Dean Urbanski as well.
A few moments later? So was her father at both the hearings? Is that what you're saying?
It appears from the facts presented in the record that Catherine first had a conversation with the dean, and then the conversation continued, I suppose you could say, when the father was contacted by phone, and the dean had a conversation. This actually, we're referring to the suspension report in the record that is Exhibit A on Defendant's Memorandum of Law in support of motion to dismiss. And the suspension there, the suspension report, and this is a school record. Now, this lists the conference participants, Catherine, Mr. Creech, Mr. Urbanski, Mr. Mimonis. It lists the parent contact date and contact time. It appears that that was a phone conversation. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yeah. Because, I mean, Goss, of course, requires only an informal conference for a suspension of less than 10 days.
Yes. Now, additionally, so we have the requisite procedural due process that is required under Goss. The facts as pled make that very clear. Additionally, we get to the Fourth Amendment and the implied Fifth Amendment issues. And there again, we contest that, in fact, the school district did have, well, it was appropriate for them to request to search Ms. Mimonis' purse. And in fact, even if they did not have consent to search, that if they had searched, that would have been valid. And so as a result, there's no unconstitutional action related to any request to search or anything about any sort of attempted search. Now, we also reiterate that, of course, as a 1983 action, and it appears that the proposed amended complaints abandoned individual claims against school officials and instead went for official capacity claims against the school district and all of the school officials. So as a result, under 1983, Ms. Mimonis would need to present not only she would need to allege not only the deprivation of a constitutional right, but also a policy, custom, or decision by a final policymaker that had resulted in the deprivation of that constitutional right. And as we spell out further in our brief, we also we argue that, in fact, she fails not only to allege the deprivation of a constitutional right, but also the policy, custom, or decision by a final policymaker that is necessary to maintain a Section 1983 claim. And all of her federal claims are brought pursuant to Section 1983. Additionally, the standard of review here, of course, is abuse of discretion. Now, the district court had the opportunity to review the complaint in full. It then had the opportunity to review a first proposed and second proposed amended complaint. It concluded that based on the facts as presented, Ms. Mimonis would not be able to sustain a motion to dismiss when it reviewed the proposed amended complaints. This court need not come to the same exact conclusion under the abuse of discretion standard, of course, but it would need to find that, in fact, no reasonable person would be able to come to the same conclusion that the district court did in that situation. If there are no further questions, we will stand on our brief and respectfully request that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Spiegel, we did ask you a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
First, to answer Judge Robner's question, there was no hearing on the actual basis that they suspended Catherine Mimonis. In fact, in the appendix, you will find not only the notice from the school district that they have the right to a hearing, you'll find their certified letter requesting that hearing, and then they were never given the hearing. At the day of school, they were told that Catherine was going to be suspended because she refused to consent to the search of her bag, purse. The only time they found, the only basis, however, set forth in writing for the suspension was possession of the cannabis in the vehicle that her sister and her sister's friend had already been charged with by the Elmhurst police. So they never had the Goss hearing, and that is perhaps inartfully alleged in the complaint, but that's why we're seeking that the case be remanded so that an amended complaint can be filed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.